Delivering this week's must-watch workplace storylines, this is Bloomberg Law's Punching In, for those of you listening in Washington and across the globe.
Hey, folks. Thanks for punching in with us today. I'm Robert Iafola, a reporter on the Labor and Employment News team at Bloomberg Law. This week, I'm joined by Professor Sachin Pandya from the University of Connecticut School of Law. Thanks for speaking with us, Professor.
Happy to be here.
Professor Pandya will talk about the laws that let workers bring employment discrimination lawsuits against companies they don't actually work for. So, Professor, as you well know, in the modern workplace, there's a whole bunch of different entities that can end up making the employment-related decisions that actually matter. For example, employers use companies to handle their background investigations for job candidates. Some employers are required to follow the policies of their corporate parents, and so on and so forth. Although these are features in today's workplace, the case law on non-employer liability under employment discrimination law goes back decades. Could you tell us about one of those early cases, the one involving the National Organization for Women?
Sure. So it's the 1970s, and the National Organization of Women and other organizations are going after newspaper publishers for publishing in the newspaper's job ad section separate spaces for job ads for men and job ads for women. So in New York, the National Organization of Women brings a lawsuit against the newspaper publisher using New York's statute, which provides that any person who aids, abets, incites, coerces, or compels another to violate the employment discrimination statute are themselves liable.
Mm-hmm.
The result is that they win. The newspapers, though not employers themselves, were liable for aiding and abetting sex discrimination, even if they hadn't intended to help anyone commit sex discrimination in any particular case. The reason the opinion seems to rely on the idea that the newspapers had enough information to be able to know that their practices made sex discrimination in hiring more likely, and perhaps because of the other features of the statute, there was no need to prove that the newspaper intended to help any particular employer commit sex discrimination or that any particular job applicant didn't get a job as a result.
Mm-hmm. And so that case was 1973 or 74, and then New York Times Court cited the Now ruling in its decision from a couple of years ago on non-employer liability for employment discrimination. Professor Pandya, could you talk a bit about the Griffin v. Serva case?
In Griffin versus Serva, the plaintiffs are two former employees of Astro Moving, a New York company. And both these plaintiffs have prior criminal convictions for sexual offenses. At the time, Allied Vanline, a nationwide moving company based in Illinois, had a contract with Astro where Astro would perform moving services for them in New York. That contract is important because it required, among other things, that employees who conducted businesses with Allied's customers, that is, employees of Astro, had to have successfully passed a criminal background check.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a conviction for a sexual offense, you automatically failed that criminal background screen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened in this case. The criminal background check occurred, the plaintiffs were fired, and then they brought a lawsuit against under New York law against both Astro and Allied for violating a provision of the statute which prohibits discrimination on the basis of criminal convictions. Now, what's important for our purposes is that the plaintiffs argued that even though their nominal employer was Astro, that Allied should also be held responsible under New York's aiding and abetting liability statute because they were, quote, any person. And so the New York Court of Appeals, which took the certified question from the Second Circuit, reformulated the question to ask whether or not that provision of New York law extends liability to an out-of-state non-employer who, we assume, aids or abets employment discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
there the court relies on the Now case to say, just in the way the newspaper publishers were held responsible under that statute, even though they weren't anyone's employer, in this case, Allied could be held responsible even though it wasn't the nominal employer of the plaintiffs.
I see. And New York isn't the only state with that sort of aiding and abetting provision in their job bias statute. Is that right?
No, not at all. In fact, New York was one of the first states to adopt a general fair employment statute covering employment discrimination. The New York Ives Quinn Law of 1945 originally contained this aiding and abetting provision. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that many years before Title VII, other states basically cut and pasted versions of New York statute into their own law, New Jersey, California, Kansas, so that today, although some states have modified it so that they are narrower in scope than New York statutes, many states throughout the country have statutes like this aiding and abetting statute, which is basically modeled on the version that first appeared under New York law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a developing area of the law, so we'll be keeping a watch on these things as courts decide whether or not to apply those provisions to non-employers. I know there's a couple of cases in Oregon that are teed up at the appellate level to see if there'll be a similar application as in the New York cases. Well, thanks for talking with us today, Professor Pandya.
Happy to do it.
All right, that's it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this edition of the Punching In podcast. For the latest labor and employment news, check out the weekly Punching In news column at news.bloomberglaw.com and click on the tab for the Daily Labor Report. If you'd like to be added to the mailing list for the weekly news column and this podcast, contact Chris Opfer at copfer@bloomberglaw.com. You can also find me throughout the week on Twitter. My handle is @RobertIofola. We'll see you back here next week.